To all our fellow members, to members of the public who are with us here today, good morning to everybody. Happy to report today, there are a number of members, regrettably, who have got colds and flus and things of this sort. We have 153 of 161 members today. I think we're getting O Canada now. Beth Husby's not here, Dorothy Coombs, Michael Pritchard, Jackie Tate, she's flooded out. She can't get through the roads. Carolyn Fader is not well. Evelyn Morrison and Sylvia Williams and Glenn McKinnon, of course, are on leave of absence. And I should mention that Ken Carty is here, but he says his head feels like a pumpkin. He's not as well as he'd like to be, but, of course, we always have Campbell Sharman as a backup, should we need that. And you know that Ken's really going to work hard. Very pleased that in the audience today from the Attorney General's office, we have Janet Erasmus, Senior Legislative Counsel, and Neil Reimer, and Carol Ann Rolfe. Is Carol Ann with us? No, Carol Ann's not here today. And Lisa Young of the University of Calgary, about from whom we'll hear later. I'm going to give about 3 minutes context and before Ken starts reviewing the STV. Three minutes. I'm going to do the kind of history of democracy in 3 minutes. That is 2,500 years in 3 minutes. I know Campbell is cringing right now because I talk about some of these things. He thinks I get it all wrong. But we know that democracy began in city assemblies, not citizens' assembly, but cities' assemblies. And they did this in Greece, of course, and not just in Athens, but several other cities. And Tony, I'm very pleased to tell you that a Harvard historian, classicist, says also at the same time a city in Italy also practiced democracy. So it's not just you can just say the birthplace of democracy was not just Greece, but Italy as well. I will be happy to send you that citation if you wish to have it for proof. But of course, the cities outgrew the idea. You couldn't, you know, when cities got larger in terms of geographical area, many the democracies broke down. And over hundreds of years, the first major transformation in democracies, according to many scholars, was what we call representative democracy. Places could get bigger, and you could still practice democracy by electing a representative who would go to some central place, meet like here, and conduct some kind of form of democracy. However, it's not been until the last 100 years that we've had the kind of mass democracy we've got today. We do know that it's not until the early 1900s that women had a vote in this country. And we know that it was in the mid-1900s before certain ethnic minorities received a vote in this country. And it's in about the last 20 years, of course, that mass democracy is practiced much as we know it today. And it's in only about the last 20 years that the majority of the people of the world actually live in a democracy. A substantial majority of the people of the world now live in a democracy. This is all leading up to a number of international scholars completing the work last year, but actually made a report last year, are wondering whether and speculating whether there is another transformation of democracy underway. They believe there is, and they're working on to try to document this. They make four observations last year in their report, four major observations about what's happening to democracies all in the world. And one is that whatever democracy you're in, there is increased skepticism about political parties and about politicians and about representative democracy. So if you feel that maybe that there is some increased skepticism in this country about politics and politicians, if it is any consolation, it is apparently widespread and it is apparent in every democracy. The other phenomenon that's apparent in every democracy, and Andre Blais talked to us about it, is that voter turnout is down in every democracy. And even though certain voting systems have a few percentage points higher in terms of turnout of voters, the downward trend is roughly the same. And as Andre told us, there's no silver bullet there. But a couple of other things are happening. And one is a huge increase, and particularly in the last 20 years, in what is called advocacy democracy. And that is citizens' groups getting together to influence government. And I've been part of many of them, and so have you. BC Teachers Federation, the Registered Nurses Association, the Fraser Basin Council, the Sierra Club, the Fraser Institute, you name them, the whole political spectrum. And these organizations are more active than they've ever been. And, of course, they do influence government. I was chatting with Ken about this the other day. Whether or not these are still the same people who vote or not is quite uncertain. Whether or not this will increase voting in the end, I think, is yet to be seen. But these people are having enormous impact on government. I do know that many organizations I belong to actually influence government policy and government funding, and this is on the rise. And then the fourth observation they make, which is very pertinent to what we're doing, is that citizens all over the world in every democracy are searching for new ways to be meaningfully engaged with government. They want to be engaged somehow in democratic governance. So enter the Citizens' Assembly on electoral reform. I think we, right here in BC, are showing other democracies in the world what can be done. That you can give citizens a very, very important task, give them the independence, and trust them to do it, and they will rise to that responsibility and do the job. So there will be a number of inventions. Democracy will always change, but I'm very pleased to remind ourselves again that British Columbia was here on the forefront inventing this new tool in democratic governance. Now, this week and next week, we have got a lot to do, and I think we're ready to do it. We are, in about a few minutes, Canada's going to review the best built STV system. We're going to spend the rest of this weekend building the best MMP system for BC. We're going to park the STV system and put it there for a while. We're going to build MMP and build that as best we can. If we get that done this weekend, we are in very good shape for the following weekend. The following weekend, we then take these two models, A and B, STV, MPP, and compare them. And we'll have a great debate. I expect we'll have a great debate in discussion groups and in plenary. And we will then make a decision as to which one of these will be the competitor, that is, which one of these we want to put alongside the current system. We will then review vigorously the current system. We will want to take a look at it and look at all its strengths, all the kinds of things that it has contributed to governance in this province, indeed this country. And we will also take a look at its perceived weaknesses. We'll then review that again with the competitor system. We then will put a question to you. Very simply put, do we retain the current electoral system? Yes or no? We'll have a debate about that, speakers about it. In the end, we will take a vote. That vote will be yes or no. And if it's yes, we will then work on building our final report, our other considerations. If it's no, we will then look to the alternative and then say to the Assembly, do you support this electoral system as a recommendation to the people of British Columbia? Yes or no. And by Sunday, next weekend, I believe that's where we will be. It's a big task, but my hunch is that I think that everybody here is ready to do it. So it's my pleasure now and to turn this over to Ken Carty, and I'm sure and I hope Ken Carty feels a little bit better today than he did yesterday. Ken.
Thanks, Jack. Some people think that I operate better when my head's fuzzier, but we'll see. Anyway, we really want to do three things this morning, briefly by way of introduction. We want to remind ourselves about the decisions about the STV system by looking at that, all those decisions as a kind of package. Because while we have to make those decisions as a series of decisions, they have to kind of sit together as a kind of coherent package. So we want to review that and just be comfortable with that. The second thing we want to do is just have a little bit of a tangent for a few minutes to talk about electoral boundary commissions. Because I know we've had a lot of questions in the last week or two since our last session about boundary commissions and how they work. And so they're going to be applicable to an STV system, but they would also be applicable to a mixed member system of some kind, as they are part of the existing kind of system. So we want to say something about that so people have that clear in their minds, and then we'll talk about the series of decisions we need to make this weekend for the mixed member system. So let's remind ourselves that in designing that STV system, we are really trying to produce what the Assembly thought was probably the optimum version of an STV system for the province. Because it's not possible to judge whether we want one or not until we know exactly what it might look like in our terms. And so it provides a kind of standard for assessing what an STV system would look like, and if we want to compare it to other alternatives, we need to have a kind of a working model, a form of model. And finally, of course, if it emerges at the end of the process as a an alternative that the Assembly might want to recommend. We will, at that stage, of course, go back and confirm all the bits and pieces. But we can't kind of decide about deciding until we have a kind of model to compare and decide about. So that's kind of what we've done, and we'll be doing the same for MMP today. Remember that in this system, just to kind of highlight the features, it provided for, as I think the MMP system will, the three basic features that the Assembly members identified as critical. It provided for local representation, but in an SDV system, we were reminded that those come from multi-member districts. It provided for proportional representation for political parties because of the way the system works. But one of the features is, of course, that this is a system which also provides room for independents to operate and to be viable candidates. And finally, it's a candidate-centered system in which voters choose amongst candidates from parties or independents. So in terms of representation, proportionality, and voter choice, it seems to meet those criteria that you set out. And these were the characteristics. Remember, we had to make decisions about six different features. District magnitude. The Assembly basically decided that they wanted to have it fairly low in rural areas so that while there wouldn't be a change in the number for the from the territory, there wouldn't be a huge expansion geographically. But there was a decision that the single-member districts didn't seem to be what members of the Assembly favored. So that seemed to rule out the so-called Nick Lunan version. But to ensure proportionality, people thought, well, you need higher district magnitudes than two, and up to maybe seven would seem reasonable in the urban areas. And those would be kind of boundary-drawn decisions. So district magnitudes would range from, say, two to seven, somewhere in there, low in rural areas, high in urban areas, densely populated areas. That seemed to be that critical decision. The second one was around the quota, and we're enthusiasts for the droop quota and enthusiasts for the hair quota, but the droop quota people seem to have the preponderance of voices. The droop quota is a little bit lower, and that makes it look more user-friendly, I think, to independents and to smaller parties. We had a very interesting discussion about the ballot form, and there seemed to be a strong feeling that candidates should be grouped by party, so that it was quite clear to voters with which other candidates they were associated and that the party was a viable actor and therefore should be represented on the ballot. But there ought to be a randomization of names and party orders across that ballot so that we have no particular advantage to being in the top left or the bottom right or ballot name order or whatever. If there's more names on a ballot, by randomizing it, then you don't give any kind of preference. The fourth decision the Assembly came to was the question of ballot completion. Do you make people fill out all the squares and indicate preferences, one to however many candidates? Or should voters be quite free to choose how many candidates they want to support? And it might be one, it might be five, and it might be two, but that ought to be a voter's decision. And and those rules have differed in different single transferable vote systems. The Assembly seemed to decide that that ought to be part of the voter choice part of the equation. The fifth thing was the question about transfers, and this is a kind of technical aspect. Really, the question is really so that you can guarantee that if you had to do a recount, the results would be exactly the same, and members thought that was quite important, so all transfers would be counted rather than just some random sample of them. And finally, there was an interesting and I think lively debate about what to do about seat vacancies. In the end, there was a preference to hold by-elections and to hold by-elections by the alternate vote system. The underlying principle is a little bit different, but it still maintains the preferential ballot and voter choice. So that seemed to be the package. That's what it looks like when you take it all together. And maybe there's people who have some observations about that or questions about that before we kind of put it in what Jack called the parking lot for the rest of the weekend. This would be a good time if people want to make some observations. Does this, in some sense, represent what had been decided?
Wendy.
Wendy?
I seem to recall that in the ballot completion rule that we thought that people would be able to rank up to the number of candidates that were going to be voted for on that district. But were we not limited? We weren't limiting to that? We were doing it for the maximum? I mean, a person could rank all the candidates?
Doug says no minimum. Do other people have other memories? Amanda.
I was under the assumption that they were allowed to rank as many or as few as they had desired.
Other people sense what Amanda's articulating the decision is right? Other comments or observations? Does it look like it holds together as what might work for British Columbia in this kind of system?
Craig.
Just looking at the write-up that we got, and looking at the northern question, the DMs of two, and talking about rural districts, I think it's important to differentiate between extreme rural and rural for going to a DM of two rather than three. And right now, we don't really make that difference, so it could just be anything outside of the city is going to DM of two.
Well, I think when the assembly comes to, if they make this decision and write it up, they might want to say what they mean by low in rural areas, high in urban. I mean, you know, that's a very brief statement. You might want to elaborate on that. I think that would be appropriate. I think that's right, Craig. Doug.
Are we in any way going to be able to give any input as to which ridings should be combined to create those DMs? Or are we simply going to leave that up to the Electoral Boundary Commission?
Ultimately, the Boundary Commission will have to do that, and I doubt if they'll actually take existing boundary districts and just push them together. They'll probably start de novo and create a new
so map. That brings up the backup question. Are any of the CA members going to be able to have any input into the Boundary Commission's decisions following our process?
Well, we'll talk a little. Everybody in the province has input into boundary commissions. We'll talk about that in a minute or two because that's an important issue about how these boundary commissions work. And they now work for the current boundaries system. Under our current system, we have these kind of commissions. Jeremy.
Thank you. Regarding completion, is there any problem with not having a minimum? I know, for example, in Tasmania, they require a minimum of five people. You must vote for at least five people on the ballot. And it was my understanding that was done to ensure that they had enough names and votes to ensure proportionality. Is there any problem without having a minimum?
David?
I really don't see a problem. There's the way it's worked in Ireland. There are some, by the time you get to the last round, there are some ballots that are exhausted, but not that many. I think it's around 5% or less, and it really doesn't make a difference. Ken actually gave me a very interesting paper last night of analysis of voting in three districts in the last Irish election where they had electronic voting. And it's clear to me, because they had electronic voting, there was a lot of opportunity to do analysis of how the votes worked. And it's clear to me that the idea that we came up with last time of, flexible number of votes is, in fact, absolutely the right decision. Because of the way that the votes are being used in Ireland, it's clear to me that we don't want to force people to vote for people that vote for candidates they don't want to vote for, and there's really no problem in the results. There's nothing sinister about the results the way it turns out.
Sure, I agree that's a better way to do it, but just wondering why in Tasmania they felt they had to have a minimum. I wonder maybe Campbell knows about that.
Campbell here? Where's Campbell?
I don't see him.
I think the reason that Tasmania has a minimum is probably reflective of the concept in Australia that you have to vote. The idea being that if you only voted for one person and then there's five candidates, then maybe you're not sort of voting properly. I think it's sort of more reflective of that than anything else.
We'll get Campbell to answer that question here.
Sure, that'd be great.
This paper David refers to, I think he's probably the only person in Canada who's actually read it. It arrived in a journal yesterday afternoon, and I haven't even had a chance to read it yet, but he obviously spent last night studying.
Here's Campbell.
Campbell, the question is, Why do the Tasmanians require everybody to produce as many preferences as there are candidates to be elected?
The problem is that if you only have, if a large number of people only fill in first preferences, and supposing you've got five members to elect, it means that the final candidate may be elected on a very small number of preferences of the people who do fill in the ballots. Now, in one sense, it doesn't matter. If people don't have a preference after the first, then okay. But one of the reasons why they've done that is that they think that five is about a reasonable number. You know, most people can count to five. And that it makes the, it enhances the apparent legitimacy of the counting. So that's the reason. Now, in Ireland, Ken can tell you about Ireland. Ireland, they don't have that problem, I think. I'm not sure why. I think because the parties. Yep. Okay. Yes. I didn't say that. But
blaming the Irishman. Yes.
The other thing is that even if you only said one preference, and there were three or five members to be elected, and the parties want to elect, have a chance of electing two or three members, then they will make it. They will instruct the voters to fill in as many as the parties think are important. But the reason why there's five in Tasmania is because it helps with the allocation of preferences.
Jeremy again.
So with the allocation of preferences, it would be more difficult then if people could vote for as many as they wanted or as little as they wanted.
No, it isn't a problem with accounting itself. It's a problem of, it's a situation. So the last person in a five-member district, supposing most people don't fill in five, the last candidate might be elected with a lot less than the first person, the quota, because there would be only a small number of votes in play. So it doesn't affect the order, doesn't affect anything, but it means that the last candidate looks as though they've got elected with fewer votes, a lot fewer votes than the first.
Thank you.
RB is next.
Where's RB? It's usually over here. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, he's still in the same seat, RB.
Yeah. Thank you. I think I also read this Wilfred Day's document with some interest. And it vividly explains what really happened in Australia. And although it is true that in the counting part of it, only the last few seats that might get affected if people don't vote for the total number of candidates to be elected. But I think we don't want to go through the same experience and, you know, have the same similar kind of failures. But if you are now trying to formulate a new system, I think we have to learn from this experience and make the system workable. I mean, with the voters having an opportunity to vote, or rather not an opportunity, to voters asked to vote for the total number of candidates to be elected in their particular region. I think it's mathematically correct, and also I think that's how it works. So if we formulate this system, we have to do it in a way it works. Thanks.
Other comments about any aspects of the package? Okay, so we've identified one or two particular items, particularly around descriptions of what's rural and around ballot completion. And if we come back to this system as when we want to decide that we want to be more precise on and perhaps revisit. Brad.
So a quick question I sent you and never really got a reply. What happens if there's a tie? Do you have a runoff between just the two top candidates or for a DM of two?
Any system has to have a kind of tie rule.
Do we set that?
We certainly could. As part of a recommendation, what happens if there's a tie? So no matter what the system, identifying a tie rule.
Would you run the full slate again and say we're starting from scratch?
I think the deputy elector officer reminded us last time that now in British Columbia, if it's a tie, they actually have a bye. We do it again. We have another whole election. Federally, I think that the deputy returning officer gets to cast the deciding vote. And typically they flip a coin. It doesn't happen very often. I think it's happened like 4 times in Fayen history. But there needs to be a tie rule. You're quite right.
Is that number 7?
That's a kind of final detail, okay. I guess, that at the end of whatever process we'd want to make sure we put it in.
So you're suggesting, Ken, if we then choose STD, those are the kind of details we'll work out in weeks 5.
Yeah, I think we do need to have a tie rule for any system.
Is there another question there? Did we see one more? Darlene.
Sorry. Could a voter actually put his votes in 1, 2, and 3 preference against one person?
No. Under these systems, you can put one number beside any given name. If someone did that, put 3 numbers beside a name, it would be a spoiled ballot.
See any more.
Anything else? Okay, just Anne, sorry.
I guess further to Brad's comment and some of the other discussion, if we have a situation where we have, let's say, candidate 4 or 5 that's getting in on a very small amount of votes, possibly we could set a minimum and do a re-by-election that way as well. So it's something to consider.
I mean, that's an option.
Yeah, in the final,
I mean,
if we look at that.
Campbell's right. It affects the last candidate. And
yeah.
So if you have a 5-member district, there's some possibility that the 5th member might get elected with some votes just short of the quota. In Ireland, it's usually a very tiny number.
Yeah.
People don't get elected a long ways from the quota. It doesn't happen.
Right. I think I don't anticipate it being an issue. People will learn how to vote, and eventually everybody will start
and
using all
the parties have
votes.
An interest in telling people to vote for all
yeah,
their candidates.
Absolutely.
And that generates enough votes. Okay. I just wanted to say one or two things about the so-called rural question, because it was an important part of the things we were talking about. And this is a system which we want to remind ourselves will increase the physical size of a district by 2 or 3 times. If a district magnitude is 2, they'll be twice as big as they are now. If it's 3, they'll be 3 times as big. But they will have 2 or 3 members. So the number of members they have for that larger area won't have declined. So if you go to a district magnitude of 2, the district is physically twice as big, but they have twice as many members. So that if you think of, say, the North, this is a system which expands the size of their individual districts, but it's a system which doesn't reduce the number of members that come from a particular region. They're just organized differently in different kinds of constituencies. And those boundaries will be drawn by an independent commission trying to work out what the interests of those local communities are. So that's the feature of STB that can sometimes be a bit confusing. It looks like the districts are getting bigger. They are physically, but in some sense not numerically, because the number of MLAs per person is not changing. Jeremy.
Is it true that if the districts are bigger and they include a larger center, such as the North, including Prince George, that most of the people elected would be tended to be dominated by the bigger urban area, for example, Prince George?
I think the experience in most places are that parties tend to spread their candidates around the district to try and attract support from all those different areas. So I think the experience of that is generally no. That because everybody outside Prince George say, well, we're not voting for that party then because they're trying to dish us. So the parties figure out very quickly it's their interest. And I think Shoney said something about that last weekend. She'd done a kind of an examination of that in Ireland and said, no, they tend to be spread out across the constituencies. Did I represent what you said right? Or were you talking to David and not listening? Okay. Well, so this brings us to the...
Ken, Julie has a question.
Julie.
Just a quick question, Ken. Has there ever been a study done that looks at the dollar value of the resources coming out of a particular area relative to the population of that area? The dollars coming out, going into the coffers of the province relative to the population of the area?
Not that I know of. I mean, there are always, when boundary commissions meet, people in resource-rich but population poor areas talk a lot about how they're funding the whole place. And but the most famous Supreme Court decision, which is actually an American one that's quoted everywhere, is that at the end of the day, politicians represent people, not trees or mines or whatever. And so at the end of the day, it's voters. And, of course, our Constitution now provides for that. And that does speak very directly to this boundary commission thing. So we need a little digression maybe about boundary commissions. And the first thing we want to remember is that any of the kind of systems we're going to be talking about, boundary commissions are necessary. Whether it's our current first-past-the-post system, and there is a boundary commission now in British Columbia. It's been here since the late 1980s when the Fisher Commission recommended it. If we had an STV system, there would need to be a boundary commission to draw these boundaries, not only initially, but every so many years to make sure they're up to date and current. And if there was a MMP system or an MMM system or an MMC or MMS, any kind of mixed system, there would also need to be boundary commissions. And they would establish the initial boundaries, but as I say, every once in a while, they would have to be redrawn. And the Canadian practice, I think in virtually all the provinces, perhaps one or two of the maritime provinces haven't quite got there yet now, is for this process to be done by impartial, nonpartisan commissions. People appointed because they are nonpartisan, they are impartial. For many years, for the first 100 years of our history, it was done by politicians in Parliament. And they really represented one of the more self-seeking kind of debates parliamentarians ever had, as they all tried to fix the boundaries to suit themselves. John MacDonald in 1885 boasted that the greatest thing he'd ever done was fiddle the Franchise Act. It was the greatest political act of his life. Not the CPR, not actually creating Canada, but the Franchise Act. Why? Because he thought he'd so fixed the electoral map the Tories would win forever. And they won once, but then they didn't win after that. Well, we're past that era, starting in the 1960s, and we now have impartial, nonpartisan commissions that draw boundaries. And the membership of these vary, but they typically have judges and thoughtful academics and clerks of the legislatures and citizens and people like that, and appointed in an impartial kind of way. The process now, since the creation of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms in the 1980s, comes under the standard set by the Charter. In Section 3 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, among other things, says every citizen has the right to vote. Many people argue that meant every citizen had a right to an equal vote. The courts have, in their interpretation, said that really means every citizen has a right to effective representation. And there have been some court decisions as to what that means in boundary drawing terms. So now we have the tradition of impartial commissions, but having to operate within what the Supreme Court has now says is constitutional. And only after the Charter of Rights and Freedoms was there this kind of constitutional constraint on them. So what are the criteria that are in the law? These ones are taken from the first one, rep by pop, the population equity criteria. This is the one that comes from the Supreme Court. And it says basically that districts have to be within plus or minus 25% of a provincial average. So let's say there's 1 million people in British Columbia and there's going to be 1,000 seats. You simply divide and you find out what the average is going to be. And if the average is 10,000 or 100,000 people in a district, then no district can be more than 25% larger or smaller than that provincial average. And that plus or minus 25% tolerance range is about the largest in the democratic world. The Australians, New Zealanders, Americans, all work on much smaller tolerances. But because of these enormous geographical variations in this country, we've kind of, at least for now, settled on the plus or minus 25 is acceptable. That takes you a long way from equality. Because if the average was 100,000, you might have some districts with 75,000, you might have some with 125,000. Well, the difference between 75 and 125 is a lot. But those are the extreme ranges. Although both in Canada and in some of the provinces, the laws also say, but there could be exceptions. And we're prepared to kind of consider exceptional circumstances are possible. The courts have not ruled very much on the exceptional circumstances stuff. The plus or minus 25%, generous as it is likely only to go in one direction. It's not likely to get bigger.
But over time, it may well get smaller if there are court cases challenging it. We don't know. But that's where we are now, and boundary commissions have to operate within that principle. Whether it's a single-member district or a multi-member district, it's the ratio that has to be maintained in terms of voters to politicians. But the commissions are always said, okay, now given that kind of mathematical range,
you ought to take into account a number of other features in drawing the boundaries. You ought to pay some attention to it.
It's not working. Back on? The red light is on. Maybe the red light's a sign. Knowing what the mathematical ranges are, you still ought to pay attention to the geographic features and to the geography and the population and the density. And this is where the kind of the rural-urban considerations come in. And most commissions have said, well, that means that we ought to have somewhat smaller districts in these big, sprawling rural areas and maybe slightly larger districts on the plus side in the urban areas. That's how it's tended to work out. Accessibility factors, how accessible are people to their... We have two mics. Boy, you're really going to be sorry. How accessible are is the population to their members? And in difficult terrains, maybe you have to make some kind of accommodations. Make sure the boundaries are drawn sensibly in a way, that maybe follow mountain ranges rather than cross them, and those kinds of things. What are the communication and transportation realities of communities? So, pay attention to the way people live and the way they organize and the way they communicate in drawing the boundaries. And let's do something kind of sensible within that kind of framework. And so that's what commissions do. And they work really quite hard at trying to produce boundaries that make sense to the people who live within them. And so that's the framework and the criteria by which they're bound, and I think will be bound in the future. So what's the process then? Well, the process is that at some established interval, a commission is formed to review the existing map and say, does it still meet these standards or do we need to change it? In Canada, we do it every 10 years. You know, we have a census in this country every 10 years. We have a census because the Constitution says we have to. And why do we put the requirement for a census in our Constitution, 1867? Because we wanted to make sure that boundaries were reviewed every 10 years. And, in fact, the origins of us having a national census are in the concern to, in a systematic, regular way, have some up-to-date numbers to review boundaries. In British Columbia, we now do it after every second election. The boundary law in the province is that after every second election, a commission's established, looks at the map and says, is it still meet the criteria? Or have population movement so has Surrey grown so much that we have to give another seat to Surrey? Has Vancouver shrunk so much that we need to take some seats out? Those kinds of things. And if they decide that a new map is required, these commissions then basically have to sit down and produce a plan, what a new map would look like, to correct for anything that's unacceptable in numerical terms or in population shifts and so on. And at that stage of the game, these commissions then publish their maps and go around the province having public hearings that any voters can come to and say, well, you know, that's not actually how it works up here. You know, where you've proposed to draw the line doesn't make any sense. And if you moved it over there and changed this, that would be better and that would make sense for us and our organizations and the way our communities work. And so commissions will have a number of these meetings. The last time the federal boundaries were changed in British Columbia, I have some experience of that. There were 13 or 14 public hearings in different parts of the province where interested parties, members of the public, politicians, MPs, anyone who was interested could come and say, well, you haven't got it quite right. And the last time the federal boundaries were changed here, there was a lot of change from the original plan. People came and said to the commissioners, look, you don't get it. This is not how it works up here. And you've got to do it this way and do it that way. And then the commissioners go back and think and say, well, yeah, we had some really good suggestions. People who have local knowledge, and they go back and revise the plan. And then they produce a final report. So there's lots of possibility for kind of input from communities about how they think within the constraints of the law and the considerations the maps ought to look. And then a final report is produced and new boundaries are formally established. And that's a pretty typical pattern for most of the boundary commissions now. So there's the legal framework, but then there's a kind of broad consultative kind of process. And I think that under any system, we're going to continue to have that, and that they will continue to redraw these maps because the population keeps changing every 6 or 7 years, depending on when elections are in British Columbia. And the reality is that populations are moving, and so the number of seats different parts of the province have continue to change. That's part of the reality. What would boundary commissions do under systems that were more like proportional representation, STV, or some kind of mixed system? Well, frankly, we don't know very much about that. There's no jurisprudence in this country because we've had no experience. We know that the court's interpretation of the Constitution has always been in the context of a single-member plurality system. And the plus or minus 25% made sense to them in that context. Whether they would think differently about the meaning of the vote, the meaning of vote equality, and therefore the instructions that had to go to boundary commissions to produce voter maps, we don't know what they're likely to say. I think we ought to assume that the plus or minus 25% rule would be where they would start. That's the kind of position. That has to be the kind of working assumption. And so for the single transferable vote, they would say plus or minus 25%, taking into account, of course, the number of members in these multi-member districts. And I think in mixed systems, they would say plus or minus 25% for these local districts. If there was a regional component to the list part, then they would maybe want to say something about that. And quite what it would be and how it would be articulated would probably depend on the nature of the court case that came. So I think we need to keep in mind that these are likely to be the working assumptions because they're the established principles. Well, any questions about these kind of boundary commissions?
Wolf has one.
Wolf.
Can I step back a little bit?
Sure.
I brought up the boundary commission because questions were asked to me. If we extend our voting district to a district, you keep the three members, the three MLAs, but would there be a chance that less candidates are participating? Because now we have three MLAs running with an average of four other people running against them. And the enlarged system is, would that same thing happen or would that reduce the chance of competition?
I think the general assumption is that most proportional systems produce more competition because there's more chance for people who don't have 50% of the support to get elected. That's part of the point of a proportional system, that you don't have to have a full majority or even the largest plurality, so that almost any proportional system can be expected to increase the amount of competition in terms of the number of candidates. It will differ from system to system. Because parties and candidates make strategic calculations about what their opportunities are. But the logic of proportional representation is that it will increase the number of parties that are competing, and it will increase the number of parties in the legislature. We know that under most proportional systems, the probability of minority governments or coalitions is much higher, and it's higher because there's more people out there running. Is that...
The thing is 15 candidates now, so still... With each MLA, there is other candidates running in each the area, or how does that work? That's what I'm unclear, or what they were unclear. Now we have three defined areas which with competition running. In a big district, would that same thing happen? I mean, now we have three electoral districts with five candidates each. In a big district, we would have the three candidates. But would there be the same amount of people running against them?
That's pretty hard to say. In a three-member district, a large political party might only decide to run two candidates, thinking that they're not going to win all three because it's a proportional system. But there will be more parties running, probably. So it's very difficult to predict. It would really depend on kind of local candidates and local parties' estimates of their chances. If they think their chances are high or better, they're more likely to run. And that's kind of the logic of these PR systems.
I got a list here. Margaret, is your question on this or something previous? I'll come back to you. Then it's Frankie. She passes. Then it's Carrie.
Just a quick question. How many constituencies do we have in BC for federal ridings?
36 now. We missed having a 37th by about 234 people or something like that.
Harley.
My question is on the boundary commissions. We have no experience here in Canada, but what is the experience in, say, Ireland and Germany and in drawing out their boundaries?
Well, the Irish have only relatively recently gone to this kind of impartial commission, and they tend to work the way that ours do. You know, they make plans, they go out and listen to, because you've got two or three commissioners sitting in an office who kind of have an overall view, but they don't know the details of local communities and what will work and what won't. They go out and they have hearings and they make some kind of adjustments. I don't know, frankly, how the Germans reorganize their boundaries.
Rob. In the past, have there been many challenges to the electoral boundaries that have been set up? And would, given that there hasn't been any experience with it, would you expect some kind of a court challenge to anything that the Boundary Commission might set up if it was a mixed or an STV system?
The original court challenges that actually produced the rules that we have actually started here in British Columbia in the late 1980s when various groups argued that the BC map was so unacceptably out of date that they wanted to challenge it and grounds that it now violated the new charter. And ultimately, the Chief Justice of British Columbia, Justice McLaughlin, said, yes, it did. And there was this new Fisher Royal Commission that had made some proposals, and the government introduced them straight away because the provincial map was now unconstitutional. The government was not very happy. That was the Social Credit government. The Attorney General was determined to appeal this to the Supreme Court of Canada, and was just about to when Justice McLaughlin was promoted to the Supreme Court of Canada. And he thought, oh, God, I'm going to go up against her again. So they didn't, and that basic decision that she wrote was then confirmed in a case that came out of Saskatchewan. So there will be these kind of court challenges around these things. There is actually now a challenge in the courts coming out of Ontario, I think partly out of the law school at the University of Toronto, claiming that the prison system's unconstitutional. You know, there's always someone, if you can find a lawyer, who can, you know, make a kind of case. The courts have not been anxious to hear this, I don't think, but it's sitting there waiting. These are people who are trying to promote, obviously, some kind of electoral reform nationally. But there may well be challenges, and I think someday there may be a challenge to the plus or minus 25 rule saying that it's too much. So far, the courts have said, no, that's reasonable. Whether in the future they'll kind of begin to shrink it down, you just never know. But that would be the direction, I think, in which there are likely to be challenges, trying to constrain the maneuvering room for commissions.
Okay, David, Shoney, Sheila. David passes. My goodness, let's put that on the record. Shoney passes. My goodness sake, Sheila.
It was mentioned to me that usually every second election that the Boundary Commission does readjust boundaries and that usually they add ridings. Is that mostly dictated by one area's population becoming larger so that they need that to make up the difference? Or like, is there a magic number of how many people are expected to be in a riding? And I guess what I'm asking, and I almost hate to bring it up, if it's dictated by the number of people that should be in a riding, would we be expecting that they might feel that the number of ridings should be increased heading into another election?
The numbers continue to grow in the House of Commons for rather complicated constitutional reasons, because you can't shrink the numbers in some of the smaller provinces. Well, about 7 of the 10, they're kind of fixed. And for various, there's a number of constitutional rules. And so if other provinces are getting bigger, the only way to kind of provide for that is to increase the size of the bigger, the three biggest provinces. In British Columbia, it's true that in the last couple of rounds, they have not they have increased the size of the legislature. And the basic reason for that has been a kind of political imperative. They've not wanted to... Basically, what's happening is more and more people are coming into the Lower Mainland, and even if populations are increasing in the north, they're not increasing as fast as the Lower Mainland, and therefore, as a proportion of the province, they're shrinking. So your population can go up, but your proportion of the province can go down, And if you're going to make for any equity, then you're going to lose seats. So Boundary Commission said, well, do we want to take seats away from some of these rural areas? Or that's hard, you know. And so rather than taking seats away from some of these rural areas, they said, well, let's just make the House a little bit bigger, and we'll give the extra seats to the urban areas as a way of kind of keeping it in balance. And so the only way you can keep it in balance is either take some away from here or add some there. And by adding there, not taking away, you're making the total pile bigger. And that's what's been going on. 20 years ago, the BC legislature was, I think, 59 or something like that members, and it's now up to 79, and it's been through a couple of these ratcheting effects, and it's because commissions have not wanted to shrink the number of total members coming from, well, the north, to put it crudely, the Cariboo North. They've said, look, they only have a certain number of members, we don't want to shrink that. So the only thing we can do is keep making the House bigger. And at some point, you kind of come up against the ceiling, right? I mean, and that's where it gets tough. But that's kind of been what the real trade-off has been.
There are no more questions, Ken, but that was really helpful. Thank you very much.
Okay, now we get down to the really fun part of the day, because we're going to talk about mixed systems. And they're deceptive. You know, we all started thinking that these were simple. We heard over and over again in public hearings that mixed systems were simple. You got to elect your constituency and you got to vote for a party, and it all came out proportionally. And conceptually, that looks neat and clean and simple. But we've learned that architecturally, they're actually kind of complex when you get into the plumbing. You know, you can have a nice-looking little cottage, but when you kind of get into the plumbing and wiring, it can get kind of complicated. So, and it's, I guess, architecturally complicated because we've got to make a bunch of different kinds of decisions. We've got to make decisions about each type in the mix. So if we have a constituency type and a PR type, we have to make decisions for both of those kinds of types, but then we also have to make some decisions about how they fit together. So, like, the architecture of these systems can be complicated. We've got lots of decisions to make. So designing such a system involves a lot of individual decisions. At the end of the day, it doesn't make the system inherently more complicated for the voters. So we want to kind of keep that in mind, I think, that, you know, when we the kind of choices we have to make look like this is a really complicated system. And that's a kind of surprise, because we all had thought that STB was complicated and MMP was easy. And now when we come to do the mechanics, it almost looks like it's the reverse. But that's because we're being plumbers and architects. And voters don't need to do that, but we need to kind of do that. So that, I think it's just helpful to keep in mind that that's what we're dealing with here, a kind of architecture problem. So these are the decisions we've got to make over this weekend, and I sent some notes out, and I thought we could just kind of review them quickly if there's any questions, and then we can go off. I'm hoping that in the discussion groups this morning we can get through the first four or five of these decisions, then come back after lunch and maybe in plenary kind of resolve some of them, and then when we go back in discussion groups, we'll have some of these first-order decisions made so that the second ones will then be put in that context. And the first question is the mix principle. And we know there's three basic kinds of mixes. There's the parallel mix, which really means there's two systems sitting side by each but not connected. There's a constituency part and there's a PR part, but they're really quite separate and they don't interact. And, of course, that provides for some proportionality, but it almost always guarantees that there'll be majority governments and works in the... And most of the mixed systems that have been adopted in the last 10 years in the world, most of them in Eastern Europe, are of this kind, of governments trying to produce some kind of stability for themselves in these new establishing places. But it's also the system that the Japanese adopted a few years ago when they abandoned the single non-transferable vote. Then there's the proportional ones. The systems that say that overall proportionality is what's key. That's what we're aiming for. So we want to build a system that is proportional. We want to have a kind of constituency element, but the principle is proportionality. And, of course, that's the German system. They created that after the Second World War. It was very successfully used there. New Zealanders have adopted it fairly recently, two or three elections ago. And finally, there's systems which we might call compensatory systems, in which we want to have some element of proportionality, but getting all the way to proportionality is more than we want or more than we need. These are the so-called MM light systems. And we had a lot of discussion in public hearings and submissions about MM light. The very detailed proposal that Dr. Anderson distributed to a lot of members recently, which he calls MMS, is a kind of version of a compensatory system, in which there is some element of this, but there's no intention to get all the way. You want to provide some opportunity for the smaller parties to have some kind of representation, but you're not convinced that you need to go to full proportionality. That increases the chances probably of having majority government and so on. So there's all kind of versions of what a compensatory system might look like. But that's kind of what they're about. They're about trying to provide some kind of representation for other parties without going all the way and therefore maybe getting into the minority government coalition politics kind of syndrome. So, like, that's the first basic principle. And it's a kind of fundamental value kind of principle. You have to kind of think about what it is you're trying to accomplish in a mixed system. And that's really what underlies that. And the second one is, if you're going to have this kind of system, what ought to be the balance between the constituency side of the system and the list side of the system, the proportional kind of system? If you want to get to full proportionality, you've probably got to be in a legislature of 79, well, then the arithmetic's a little bit, you've probably got to be probably pretty close to 40% on the list side. You get much below 40%, you're going to have a hard time getting full proportionality. But if you're into the MMS or MM light kind of system, then you can go much lower because you're not worried about that. And there is a range. There's no kind of magic standard. The Germans use 50-50. The New Zealanders are in the kind of 60-40 range. It's not exactly 60-40 because they have a very complicated process for deciding how many seats will be in each category. They have one fundamental starting principle. There'll be 16 constituency seats in the South Island. When you know that, then everything else kind of meanders through and you finally work it out. But, you know, that's what they've decided. So that's where they start, and they know they're going to be 120 at the end. And there's a whole lot of stuff in between. But it comes down to around 60-40. In Wales, they've gone to two-thirds constituency, one-third list in a small legislature. And the Labour Party wins, I think, almost every single constituency seat. I mean, it's a kind of one-party state anyway. It's very difficult to get full proportionality when you get that far down. So, like, that's the second kind of question you need to have. And, of course, it partly flows from what are you trying to do in the first one. So that's the second set of decisions that you would need, big fundamental architectural question. The third question of an architectural sort that you need to think about is about candidates and where can they run. And there are three kind of possibilities. You can say they must run on both the lists and the constituency side. So there's a list of constituency candidates and a list of PR candidates. You can say candidates must run on both. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that the system that the Quebec government is just fine-tuning now and claims it's going to introduce in its National Assembly the next week or two will recommend something like that. I guess the argument is about this means all the politicians have to kind of go out and face constituents and fight these kind of battles and so on and have had the same kind of experience. And if, of course, you want to move to a kind of best loser kind of list arrangement, then they've had to have run. You can have a system in which they're free to run on one or both as they like. And that's been actually typical of most of the MMP systems that we know of Germany and New Zealand and Scotland and Wales, and parties can choose to do that. What it means is you're never quite sure who the list candidates likely to get elected are because you don't know whether they're going to be elected on the other side first. If you wanted closed lists that were zippered, you might say, well, you might not want to do this because you don't know who's going to win the constituency seats, and that would disrupt the zippering side. So, like, that's connected to those kinds of issues. And finally, you could say, well, people got to choose one side or the other. They're either a list-type politician or they're a constituency-type politician. We're going to separate them. They're going to have clear and distinct roles, and they're never the twain shall meet. And there might well be arguments for doing that. So some decision about that is part of the basic question you've got to deal with. Then there's the access to the list issue. This is, of course, around the so-called Italian trick kind of problem, so that parties can't run their candidates on one side as constituency and use a quite different name on the list side, and by doing that, turn an MMP system into an MMM system. And so if parties want to run on the list, do they have to run some constituency candidates under their own name? I mean, do they have to expose themselves to the voters on the same side? And if so, how many candidates do they have to run? Do they have to run in all constituencies to have access to the list? Do they have to run in just a few? That's not an easy decision, because let's say you had a party that decided it wanted to represent the interests of Vancouver Island. And maybe there were, 10 or constituencies on Vancouver Island. But the rule said that you couldn't have a list unless you ran candidates in 15 constituencies. Then you would essentially be precluding that kind of party from having a list. So, like, different kinds of rules will structure the opportunities that different sorts of parties might have to have access. So questions is, do you have to have it run some candidates? If so, how many? Does it have to be a province-wide distribution? Those things are all kind of possible. The fifth question is, how many votes do you want to let people have in such a system? MMP systems have, for the most part, now give people two votes, one for their constituency candidate and one for the party they prefer. The Germans started by having just one vote. When you have just one vote, it's for the constituency, and then you add up all those constituency votes, and those are used as the party votes. If you have two votes, you facilitate vote splitting. So people can vote for small parties, typically on the list, and larger parties' candidates in constituencies, because larger parties' candidates are more likely to win in a constituency. So two votes probably makes it easier for small parties, facilitates vote splitting of one kind or another. If you only have one, it's a way of asserting the primacy of the local vote in the process, and it's probably going to have fewer numbers of parties emerging in the process. So even simple things like that are likely to have some kind of implications in the kind of the number of candidates that are running and how they run and how voters will respond. And the sixth thing we have now, so those are like five big framework architecture kinds of questions. If you could get those settled in the groups this morning and we could decide those in plenary after lunch, that would be terrific, because then we would have that as a kind of framework for then looking at the specifics of the two sides of the list. So I would hope that we could get somewhere there. Then there's a constituency seat rule. Do you want a plurality or an alternate vote in the individual constituency side? Then we get into the really exciting stuff. On the list side, the proportional side. Where do you want to allocate the seats? And that really means, where is proportionality measured? Is it measured on a province-wide basis or maybe on a regional basis? A province-wide model is what they do in New Zealand. The whole country, and that's the proportion. In Wales or Scotland, they say, no, we want proportionality in each of the distinctive regions. And, of course, you add up those and you don't get the same numbers as you would maybe if you did proportionality system-wide. But having even decided those kind of vote shares, then there's the question, well, who actually gets to sit in those seats? And do they come from regional lists or province-wide lists? And the province-wide list, the equivalent would be what the New Zealanders do. They have one list for the party for the whole system. In Germany, they decide on a national basis what the vote shares will be, but then when they come to actually fill those seats, they look at lists drawn from each of the different Länders, the different regions of the country, so that there'll be representatives from those different regions in it. So when you think of those two things, you've got three possible combinations. You can have provincial proportionality from a single provincial list, kind of equivalent to New Zealand. You could have provincial allocation, but seats filled from regional seats of candidates. That would be kind of equivalent to the German case. And if you're looking for a useful submission that actually goes through the mechanics of how you actually do that, Wilfred Days, which I think is number 1203 in the submission form, actually tells you, illustrates the mechanics of that, and it's a little complicated. But you could also have regional allocation and regional lists, as they do in Scotland. The first is going to get you closer to proportionality. The last will probably be farthest away from full proportionality. But, you know, that's a matter of degree. Okay, the next set of questions about the list seats, of course, are about the lists. Are they to be provincial lists or regional lists? That's partly determined by how you want to allocate the seats, the decision you've just maybe wrestled with. How complete does a list have to be? Could you have a list of one name? In effect, can an independent be a list all by him or herself? Or does a party have to produce a certain number of names on a list to be kind of legitimate? And if you want regional lists, what will the regions be? What will their sizes be to do this? And if we have lists, are they going to be open or closed? Closed lists essentially involve taking the candidates as produced by the party. Although one version of that might be the so-called best losers closed list. And that would be that would require, of course, that you have candidates running. All candidates would have to run in constituencies so you could identify best losers. But that would be a way in which the voters would have identified who they wanted off the fixed list of candidates that were on offer. Open lists, there's all kinds of ways of doing that. You need to think about, you know, what makes it genuinely open. Are there ways of doing that? I think Campbell has distributed, it's sort of the finished so-called ballot distributed. You'll see in the package that he's put on the desk a finished ballot. That's the ultimate open list. Can I see this? It's the one that looks like this. And what you see is that the parties actually produce a list of names up on the wall of the voting place. And then you identify the candidate from the list you like. You will see what number is beside that candidate. You just write it in that little circle. You just write the number of the candidate. Now, when they go to count those, first of all, they're counted as if they were party votes. So how many votes do all the candidates in the parties get as a way of deciding, of course, proportionality? But then once they've decided that, then they look at which candidates got the most votes. And so the voters decide which candidates from the party's list are going to fill those seats. So that's a form of the most open kind of list that is really used. And there's all kind of variations maybe in between. That shows you what it might something might look like. Okay, then for the mathematically enthused, there's the formulas, the DeHaunt formulas and the hair quotas and all the rest that actually decide on proportionality. And I just gave you the Farrell reference as a kind of reminder of what's that, what's there. Then there's a question of thresholds. Do you want to have thresholds, i.e. minimums that parties must meet before they get anything out of this system? And there's different kinds of thresholds. And perhaps they've got to win a certain number of constituency seats, or perhaps they have to win a certain vote share. And once you've decided what kind, then what would the level be? So in New Zealand, they actually have both kinds. They say you have although they have it on an either-or basis. You could win one constituency seat, and if you do, no matter what your vote share is, you're entitled to some proportion of the seats. Or if you win 5% of the national vote, then you're entitled. So you could have or, you could have both, or there's lots of different kind of ways in which you could have thresholds. And the purpose of thresholds is to keep small parties out. That's all it's for, is to keep people out you don't want in. And you think about why you'd want to do that and who you'd want to keep out. Then there's the delightful question of the overhang seats. And this is created by a situation particularly prevalent when you have a regionalization of these kind of systems, where a party might actually win more constituency seats in an area than they were entitled to proportionally. Let's say you had a region in which there was going to be 12 members elected, 6 on the constituency side, 6 on the list side. One party won all 6 of the constituency seats. But their vote share might have only been 40%. Well, they've won 50% of the seats, but they're only entitled to 40% of them. So do you take a couple of them away? Or if you want to have full proportionality, do you have to add some seats to the other parties to get them up to their relative proportion? And if you add some extra seats and say, well, you won those fair and square in the constituencies. We're not going to take them away. So we're going to have to add, to get the full proportionality, that means the legislature gets a little bit bigger for that one term till the next election. Those are the so-called overhang seats. You could say, well, we're not going to have overhang seats, and that would just simply mean you wouldn't get the full proportionality. But you need to kind of address that kind of possibility. Then there's the seat vacancy provisions. How do you fill empty seats on both the two sides? And finally, what do you want a ballot to look like? And there are some illustrations. You'll see there's some examples of New Zealand ballots there. And if you look at them, you'll notice that they're organized side by each on one piece of paper with the candidate of a particular party right beside the party. And that's an attempt to encourage people just to kind of make two ticks right side by each. Vote for this candidate, vote for that party, rather than kind of randomizing them or giving two separate ballot papers, a paper for the candidates, a paper for the parties. And so, you know, those provide for subtle differences, but what kind of ballot papers would you want? So, like, that's a lot of decisions, eh? I mean, it says 9, but 7 has about 6 of them embedded, so there's 15 or 16. And so it sounds like it's really complicated. But if we think of it, this is just like the blueprints. These are the architecture that we need to kind of work through to produce a system that we understand conceptually and in clear terms. We don't need to let it kind of frighten us. And, of course, most voters don't need to be concerned about this kind of plumbing and, as they aren't in any kind of system. So are there any questions about any of these kinds of things? It's all just simple and clear. Oh, Anna has a question.
Shoni and Wilf got one.
And I saw Anna first. Sorry. Anna?
Yeah, are we able to recommend that they increase the number of seats in that overhang situation?
I don't know. That's a kind of tricky question because you could say, well, we're not increasing the size of the legislature. We're just providing for a one-time anomaly. So I suppose you could make that kind of argument. You know, it would generate whatever backlash it did. Shoni, I think Jack said. And
Wilf. And then Gene, we're going to try and shut it down if we can.
As I understand this, an independent would have absolutely no chance on a list. Is that right?
I think that's pretty right. Independents would pretty well have to run in districts. Now, if you had small regions and you allowed one-party lists, independents might be able to, in a small region, engender enough popular support. But I think basically, fundamentally, that's right. Independents would be really realistically constrained to the constituency side. And if the constituency side was too small, let's say you went to a mixed member system in which you wanted 80% lists and only 20% constituencies. I mean, I don't know if anybody wants to do that. But if you did, you might risk a constitutional challenge saying you've really foreclosed the possibility for independence. Because the other part of Section 3 says every citizen has the right to vote and the right to be a candidate for election. And at some point, but I think your basic observation, is, I would say, is probably right.
Probably last question to Gene.
Gene.
I'm having some trouble understanding. I want an example for you. Item 3. C, seatless eligibility for candidates must choose one side of system or other. Can you elaborate on that, please?
Well, you could have a system in which you said you can be a candidate in a constituency or you could be a candidate on the list, but you can't be both. So we're going to make these quite clear and quite separate and distinct.
Are there any jurisdictions that use that? That's what I'm looking for.
None of the MMP systems I know use it. I don't know the details of all the MMM systems. So there's no MMP systems I know that do that. That require people to choose one side or the other and force them into two camps. There is, I think, in Wales, because of the peculiar constellation of that system, some unhappiness with the way it's worked because It's a way of ending the so-called zombie problem, right? You can't have zombies in this kind of system because You can't have been defeated in a constituency and elected in a list. There is one constituency in Wales with a constituency member and three other people who ran against him or her. I can't remember who the victor was. All who got elected on their party lists. So there's one district that has these four members, and these other three are claiming, of course, to be the real member. And it makes the member who's doing all the work crazy. And it's created a certain amount of tension. Now, that's a peculiarity when you've got one district with, it happens to have four people. And so if you wanted to avoid that problem or that phenomenon, this would be a way of doing it, because it just wouldn't arise. You might say, well, that's an awfully extreme distance to go to prevent that problem, but that's the way you could solve it. Is that clear, Gene? Okay, well, I've taken a little bit longer than I thought. What we want to try and do is, if we can get through 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and even maybe into 5, the rest of this morning, when we come back after lunch and have a plenary discussion like we did last Sunday morning, that would be terrific, because then we would know when we get into the really fun stuff about the lists, kind of what the framework we're dealing with is. So are they allowed 2.5 minutes for coffee, Jack?
Yeah, coffee is going to be served by your discussion groups, you're in the Center for Dialogue. So just take it into your rooms. Those who are outside, your coffee's in the concourse, take it to your room so you've got 2 hours for discussion.